This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. The remnants of Hurricane Frances swept across western North Carolina yesterday, hitting Asheville particularly hard. Much of the area was underwater, and now some parts are without water pressure and without drinking water. The local newspaper, the Asheville Citizen-Times, is bailing out their own building because water engulfed, among other things, the newspaper's restrooms. Yet while rising water is hard to ignore, Asheville has other things on its mind as well: the coming elections, the war, the ongoing battle over annexations. Farther east of Asheville, the citizens of the Fayetteville area are also paying attention to the weather, the war, and annexation. And so, as part of our new series, checking in with newspaper editors around the state of North Carolina, we welcome today Joy Franklin, who is editorial page editor of the Asheville Citizen-Times. Welcome, Joy.
Thanks. Glad to be with you.
I'm glad you're able to be with us today, considering all those floods. And Tim White is with us, too. He's editorial page editor of the Fayetteville Observer. Welcome back to the show, Tim.
Thanks so much, Melinda. We're still working on our arc here, so I'm glad the rain stayed to the west.
Well, Joy, let's start with you, the flooding in the Asheville area, the western part of the state. How bad is it today?
Well, it's starting to recede. We hope that continues. Some areas, though, haven't apparently crested yet, at least according to the Weather Service. Some of the rivers haven't crested yet. But in other areas, it's definitely starting to recede. On my way into work this morning, there were areas that were underwater yesterday that were off the road. I mean, the water was off the road. Mm-hmm. And let me just clarify one thing about the water situation. As far as our restrooms are concerned, we are without water in our restrooms. That's true. But it's not because they were flooded. Mm-hmm. We're actually in an area downtown that was not affected by the water coming up. But it did, the flooding did break a line from between the water facility, the water plant that we were using, and Asheville. And so the entire city of Asheville is without water for the next 24 hours.
Right, right. Well, thank you for clarifying that. And that is the paradox, because you had water everywhere, but
not a drop to drink.
because of this, because of broken water lines caused by the flooding. Indeed.
That's right.
Are they putting any estimate on what it's going to take to clean this up?
I don't think there's an estimate yet. It's just too early to tell. We have an enormous amount of damage, as far as I can see, just seeing with your eyes. A lot of buildings are underwater. Fortunately, we've had no deaths. We had two people rescued in some pretty hairy under some pretty hairy conditions, and we've had one animal shelter that was just completely flooded. I mean, it was right next to a creek two creeks, in fact, that just totally overflowed their banks. And so there's been a tremendous rescue effort to get the animals out of there. There are about 500, 600 animals in that shelter. And they're now being housed. 10, I believe, did die, about 10. They're not exactly sure how many were drowned. But there has been sort of a rescue shelter set up for them on an old prison, on the old prison grounds, thanks to a couple of our local representatives, apparently. And so that's all creatures great and small in Hendersonville, and they really need help now, because they're probably going to have to replace that shelter.
Well, and one other aspect of this was in an editorial today, or there was a column in your paper that talked about how localized this might be. That I found this interesting, that people on one side of a ridge may have thought it was just a gully washer, just a bad storm, and others were just totally underwater.
And that's right, and that's because of our topography. Mm-hmm. It's so mountainous, the water will of course pool in the low areas, and so neither of my colleagues could make it in the editorial department could make it into work yesterday, because they were both literally on islands. They both lived up a hill somewhere, and the water was surrounded their homes, or all the roads that came out from where their homes were, and they couldn't get out, and so
it's as though you had atolls in the western hills of North Carolina.
That's right.
Yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, Tim White, I'd like to talk with you about a little bit about this. I saw in your paper too that you had rain in the region too, in the southeastern part of the state today.
Nowhere near as bad as what they had in Asheville. We certainly had plenty. In Fayetteville, we got about 2 3/4 inches of rain,
yeah.
But some of the surrounding communities got up to about 5 and a half inches.
And we didn't even consider ourselves technically hit by the hurricane, but we're sure seeing the effects of it.
No, and we were on tornado watches all day yesterday. Several were spotted in this area, and there was quite a bit of damage. It was pretty spectacular, especially just imagining what kind of damage was wrought by the hurricane a few hundred miles south of our region.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to turn to the economy in both of your towns. Polls are indicating that as we have the elections looming, the economy is weighing heavily on people's minds. What's the mood in Fayetteville, Tim White, about the economy?
It's upbeat, but acknowledging that we've got some longstanding problems. As a matter of fact, we have a story in today's paper about tourism spending in this area, and Cumberland County has now joined the top 10. We're not up there with Asheville quite yet, but our total expenditures in 2003 in Cumberland County was just about $300 million in tourism revenue. This has to do with more with business travel, more with military, National Guard people coming to town for training, things of that sort. But it also illustrates one of the biggest problems that this area has is that most of our economy is rooted in the service-related industries, whether it's food service or retailing or hotel, motel, and that sort of thing, which are traditionally the lowest paying kinds of jobs in most economies. And so while we're really happy for the $300 million that was spent here, it turns out that only about $71 million went back out the door in the form of payroll, which is nowhere near what kind of money we'd really like to be having. So a lot of effort is going on here in economic development and trying to bring in new employers that are of the sort that tend to pay a lot better than the service industry does.
Well, Joy Franklin, there's a parallel in the Asheville area, too, because if I recall correctly, the name of the baseball team is the Tourists.
Yes, that's right.
And so you have a very tourism-centric industry there and service sector, too.
Yes. The tourism industry here, I think, is still the top part of our economy. And it's a... also, highly service industry, a lot of service industry jobs, but there are also a lot of pretty high-paying tourism jobs in Western North Carolina because we have the Biltmore State and we have a number of other, the Grove Park Inn, where there are a lot of people who are making pretty good salaries in tourism, but we've lost a lot of manufacturing jobs here, and that's been a statewide phenomenon. But those manufacturing jobs were really, really important to the region. And so, as is the case in Fayetteville, where there's a lot of effort being devoted to trying to recruit new industries, and what we're really looking for are smaller companies and locally, we're trying really hard to get locally grown companies that the people have loyalty to the region. We expect them to stay here and grow their companies here, and we're looking for things that fit well with our geography, things that don't require big, huge manufacturing plants because we just don't really have a lot of space for that sort of industry. So we're looking to biotech and higher tech industries.
I understand both your towns are coping with the issue of annexation. Tim, there's a conflict there involving 43,000 people?
Well, 43,000 people, 28 square miles. The city heretofore has done small annexations, little bites at a time, a neighborhood at a time. As they reach the level of urban density, the city takes them over and expands a little bit. But the city had a long-term plan for annexation, looking at which areas were becoming urban in nature and which ones they were going to start bringing into the city from the county, and decided a little over a year ago that they were going to do what became nicknamed the Big Bang annexation. And it's 43,000 people, 28 square miles. It was indeed a big bang, as we said frequently in our editorials. It's analogous to Fayetteville suddenly adding the city of Goldsboro. It was a big bite. And the annexation lasted all of one day when three different lawsuits absolutely shut it down, and the state Supreme Court said, nope, everything goes back to where it was before. And so the city had committed millions and millions of dollars into the annexation, hiring dozens, many, many dozens of new employees, police, fire, buying all these new police cars and so forth. And all of that is back on a shelf right now. Of course, the city's already paid for it, and they're not getting any tax revenue coming back in. So a mess would be a kind way of describing it right now.
Right. Enjoy. You're dealing with similar things there in Asheville?
Yes. In March, the city annexed about 140 acres with about 900 people. But they also passed a resolution that would designate 69 square miles of Buncombe County for annexation over the next 2 years. And, of course, the city has said that doesn't mean all of it will be annexed, but it's for study, to be studied to be annexed. And, of course, most people in areas about to be annexed don't want to be annexed because they don't want... In this area, I don't know if this would be true in other areas, but they don't want the land use regulations particularly, and they don't want to pay the extra taxes. And so we haven't had any lawsuits filed to my knowledge yet, but there are some very unhappy people.
Right. And cities tend to want to annex, do they not, Tim White, because, well, they could get extra revenue from those places, and they might have ideas. What would be the other impetus for a city to want to annex?
Well, the other impetus is really the reason why the legislature passed this law in the first place, and that is as a rural area becomes increasingly urban and the population densities grow, county government really isn't set up to administer urban areas. But cities are, and so the theory is that as the suburbs around a city become denser and denser, the county loses its ability to provide some of the services. Counties aren't usually set up to do things like sewer and water and garbage collection and things of that sort that an urban area actually needs. And so it's the other end of this argument is that really it's a city's duty to begin to provide those services to areas as they become urban.
Tim White, we're going to have to hold it there for a moment, and we're going to come back and continue our conversation with Tim White of the Fayetteville Observer and Joy Franklin of the Asheville Citizen Times, checking in with newspaper editors across the state about the issues going on there. And we'll be talking in a moment about how the war is playing in both of those towns. That's just ahead on the state of things. We'll also be talking later with Raleigh author June Spence about her new book, Change Baby. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we're talking this hour with Joy Franklin, editorial page editor of the Asheville Citizen Times, and Tim White, who is editorial page editor of the Fayetteville Observer. We're doing this as part of a new series to get a pulse on those stories that are happening across the state. Well, I want to look at how folks in your areas, perhaps through letters to the editor or other ways, how they're talking about the war in Iraq right now. Tim White, you're in Fayetteville, huge military presence in that town. How's that playing there? Are soldiers paying attention to the disputes in the election right now over President Bush's service record or John Kerry's record in Vietnam?
We're getting some mail from active duty service people, but I've got to say the bulk of our feedback is coming from military retirees who are legion around here, and they are the ones who have both the time and the inclination to sound off about it. And the interesting thing is we're not getting uniformly pro Bush anti Kerry letters from the local writers. And even from the local veterans, about 2 weeks ago, we had a couple of Kerry's Swift Boat veteran people that served with him here for a Democrat, a pro Kerry rally, and the pro Kerry people outdrew the antis by about 2-1. It was kind of surprising to me.
And is that something of note in the town of Fayetteville that would happen?
It certainly is.
Yeah.
It certainly is. I'm getting the sense from at least some retirees, some military people, that there is not a uniform we're right and they're wrong kind of feeling about the war, and that some people are beginning to say maybe this wasn't such a good idea after all.
Joy, Asheville has a reputation for veering less to the right historically.
Asheville itself, not the region, but Asheville itself, yes.
Yeah. So how is the war and the election playing out there? You have a couple of National Guard units that from the Asheville area that have been in Iraq since for a good long time now.
Yes. Well, we have letters going pretty much both ways. I mean, we're getting our letters to the editor really are concentrating on the national race. They're not concentrating on there's some on the very local races, but state races just seem to be under the radar completely up here. And I think that it is very much focused on the war and also on the economy, because both of those are affecting us strongly. We do have three National Guard units that have been deployed, and there was a Wall Street Journal story I thought was a really front-page Wall Street Journal story that focused on one of them, the 211th, and they've served two tours of duty. And in both of those, one of the quotes in the Wall Street Journal story was, after the second deployment, a lot of soldiers just said, forget it. The overwhelming feeling is that they are tired. They have just had enough. And, you know, I think there is a pretty good sense that the military is overextended and it's overusing and using up the National Guard. And but on the other hand, I think that there is a lot of patriotism here by people on both sides of this issue. There's a strong patriotic feeling here. And our letters, we're probably getting more letters criticizing the way the war in Iraq is being executed. But having said that, I think you do tend to get more complaints from people who are unhappy in terms of the election. I mean, more letters from people who are unhappy in the election. And so I'm not sure whether that's any kind of read on how people here really feel.
Well, finally, I understand you both are in the process right now on the editorial staff of your papers. You're in the process of interviewing local candidates and deciding on endorsements, perhaps even for state races. Can you tell us a little bit about how that happens? Do the editors take a vote? Do they make sure that the candidates come in at the boardroom like they would do at the New York Times at the presidential level? How does that work? Tim White?
Actually, we're one of the rare newspapers that does not do endorsements. This paper has a long-standing policy against doing them, endorsements of individual candidates. We do endorse specific issues, like Amendment 1 and that sort of thing. But no, we don't. So we have a lot of very disappointed candidates who call us up and are most anxious to come in here and meet with our editorial board until they hear that we don't do endorsements.
Why don't you do that?
Because of the impression that many people have that if a newspaper does endorsements, that its news coverage also is going to favor that individual candidate.
And Joy Franklin?
We are in the process of interviewing candidates. We'll be interviewing virtually everyone who's on the ballot for Buncombe County and probably for Haywood County as well. Well, and for Haywood County as well. And we are also trying to work to arrange gubernatorial debate in Western North Carolina. We're cooperating with Western University to try to work that out. And we do invite the candidates to come in and meet with us for a 30-minute interview. We do interview them in the boardroom. And we have 9 members of our editorial board. 3 of those are community members. And we sit down and slug it out and we try to have a broad range of political philosophies represented on the board. And so we really look for leadership more than we look for, we're not looking for whether these people agree with us so much on the issues, although that's a factor. But we're primarily looking for, is this person credible? Is this person have integrity? Does this person have leadership skills? Will this person be able to get things done? You know, things that we think are more important than where somebody stands on a specific issue, unless their stand on some issue is just, you know, completely in disagreement with what we believe to be right. And that seems to be, they're sort of one issue candidates.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Yes.
Thank you both. Joy Franklin is editorial page editor of the Asheville Citizen Times. Tim White is the editorial page editor of the Fayetteville Observer. And with the weekend ahead, we'll be looking later on in the program into rock climbing in North Carolina. Are you a climber? What's your favorite park? We'll talk all about that later on in the show. You can give us a call with your review of the state's climbing centers. The number here is 1-877-962-9862. Chances are you've probably met someone like Evie Gose. She is 24 years old, sharp-tongued, both wise and weary beyond her years. But her familiarity might end there, as her family history is likely stranger and more complicated than that of almost anyone else. Avie is the heroine of the new novel Change Baby. It's the first novel by celebrated short story writer June Spence. June Spence was raised in Raleigh. She lives there now, and she's with us in the studio today. Welcome, June.
Thanks. Hi.
And congratulations on this first book. It's a wonderful read.
Thanks. It's fun to finally see it here in the flesh. So
yeah, it's been, what, 6 years in the making or so?
More or less. I mean, it's a good year or more just from getting the manuscript through the publishing process, putting it on the map and stuff. But I would say a good 4 years, which was probably about 3 years longer than I wanted it to be to get there.
Well, I want to talk about that in just a moment, yeah, about the transition from being a short story writer to that. But first, let's talk about the book itself. The title, Change Baby, it doesn't mean what it could mean, a directive like, it's time to change,
sure,
baby.
Sure, sure.
In fact, it's a reference to menopause.
Yeah, it's an expression that, I don't know if it's so much Southern, but it's definitely a rural expression that means that baby, that it's almost as if there's a sort of belief in this final burst of fertility you might have right before menopause. And you will see this in families, especially large families, where there's a gap of years. So you'll have these grown children and then suddenly a new addition to the family when the mother's in her 40s. And so the main character is the change baby, younger than her siblings.
And that's Avie. And
yeah,
she was born when her mother...
Supposedly when her mother was in her late 40s. So she's very much a change baby. Her two siblings she barely knows. They've long since moved on. There's a great deal of generation gap going on within this family.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to give away too much here, but
sure,
you did use the word supposedly. Her mother's 49.
Yeah.
Okay. But we'll let the readers get to that. That's part of what propels this novel. It's a book about belonging to a family, a place, even an illness. There's alcoholism that runs through her family.
Sure, and sort of a coming to see how those things are connected. This, I think, as a person, because she's so much younger and so disconnected from her other siblings, never really saw quite what her place in the family was, and a lot of the story of the novel, I think, revolves around her connecting back up with what it means to be a member of this family and the fluidity with which the term family is used, who belongs to who in a family.
Right. Well, we should explain that in the story we have Avie, who's in her mid-20s. She's been working in Ohio after growing up in this town in North Carolina. She's come back to her aging mother, whose house had caught fire. Now, the town she returns to is called Regina, or
yes,
Regina or Regina?
Regina.
Which is an anagram for Anger, which is your family sometimes?
My parents and grandparents are all from Anger. And to people who live in Anger, this is a very fictionalized version of Anger, which is why I went for an anagram and not the actual name, but very much an Anger of my imagination and memory.
Right. And so when Avie gets home, she wittingly and sometimes inadvertently, she uncovers many of her mother's secrets. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. Some of that is coming home. She had sort of an excuse for coming home. She needed to escape her own situation. And this was sort of a noble way to do it, an effort to come home and help her ailing old mother. But yeah, she gets a lot more than she bargained for.
Yeah, and this is about secrets, as we alluded to before. Can you keep secrets of the kind that you have in this novel? Can you keep secrets like that in a small town like Regina or Anger?
Yeah, there's sort of open secrets, I think. It's sort of things that everybody knows, but there's a conspiracy to protect. And when enough time passes by, too, that becomes the truth. The sort of the cover story that you have for things become true. Anybody who knows better eventually dies off. I mean, I think that's part of how that works. And also, I think as a child, I know for myself, there's a decided lack of curiosity. You take in your own context, you take a lot of things for granted. You're the center of all stories, you think, and it's not until much later that you peer a little more closely at the context you're in. I think that's the perfect situation that she finds herself in when she returns home.
Maybe as a kid, you don't think that those adults around you have a backstory.
No, because you're the story. You're the, especially this lone child who is, you know, she understands quite well how spoiled and coddled she's been, and she's just been used to being the center of things. Finding out otherwise is sort of everyone's rite of passage.
Yeah, well, she's in effect an only child, and therefore the center of the universe,
yeah,
right? But I've heard that you've said that this book is not autobiography.
Yeah.
But it is biography.
Yeah, there's a lot of different family stories that are, I think, very transformed in this. In fact, my one surviving grandmother sort of guilted me into letting her read an early draft because she caught wind that there might be an allusion to something involving her mother, which there is, and I think that was her main. She wanted to see it and possibly put an end to it if it was something she didn't like how it was portrayed. There's a number of family stories that from both sides that kind of weave together and become something else. The one I think she was most worried about, and in the end decided she was very satisfied with the way that I portrayed it. Her own mother at about age 16, 17, having been married at 15, with two very small children, my grandmother, one of them, kind of lost it and took off one day. I mean, this is a young girl who'd probably never left Anger, maybe never had never been any further than Raleigh. And she went away to Richmond intending to find a new job, start a new life, eventually send for her kids. And in a short amount of time, but long enough to be kind of impressive, I think a few months, she came home and had a very happy next 60 plus years of marriage with her husband, raised her kids. But that was always a sort of secret little story that shows up in another way in the novel. So there's lots of things like that.
And there's another storyline here, too, that I understand is based on some story in the family about a man who essentially lives with two women.
Yeah, there's
another open secret in the town of Anger?
Not so much the town of Anger. I think these old Spence ministers were out of Clibbet, actually.
Now, where is that?
Clibbet Springs is not that far from Anger, and I've only passed through it a few times, and but there are some Spences from my dad's side. There were supposedly some brothers, some ministers, and they were rather flexible in their in their rules of living, but the justification. One of them supposedly lived with two women, one a wife and one a sort of concubine, and had children with both. And the rationalization was he had progressed in his relationship with God to the point that he could no longer sin.
that's convenient to be making that call.
It's sort of marvelous.
That makes the call.
Gives you a lot of leeway.
Well, it sounds like you had a lot of material to work with there.
Yeah.
Well, you have made a reputation for yourself as being a short story writer. Mm. And you manage in your short stories to portray character through first person. And I was wondering if you might read one from a very short story. It's called Let a Sleeping Love Lie. And in this scene, we have a woman who goes into the Quick Mart, into the convenience store, and she runs into her ex-husband, who asks if there's anything he can do for her.
Sure. You doing all right? You need anything? Roy, just grinning like he knew what I needed. I found myself telling him that the water heater was on the blink again, thinking that if I'd bought a new one instead of paying for a divorce, I'd always have a warm bath. But I'd still have a rotten husband, and sometimes a cold shower is just the wake-up call I need.
That's June Spence reading from one of her short stories, Let a Sleeping Love Lie. How was it to make the transition to novels?
Oy. It was, I was very naive. I had an idea. I knew it was bigger than a short story, but I didn't know what it would take to do it. And all my chops were in writing short stories. I was used to, you could kind of go with a vague idea, cut a few characters and see where they went. And that could get you around the arc of a short story. I think I thought, well, chapters are like little stories and I'll just write one after the other and that'll add up to a novel. And so a lot of my floundering, I think, had to do with the sort of bigness, the awesomeness of it, and realizing that it couldn't just be, I had to write little increments. I mean, that was a necessary part of it. But at some point I needed a backbone. I needed to really do the sort of outlining that you hear people talking about and thinking about a bigger plot. And it was a long time before I was really ready to do that. I had, in fact, I had a lot of pages at one point, unfortunately, they were not consecutive pages, and they weren't adding up. And I think that was the biggest challenge. How did all these people I had in mind and their situations come together as one larger story?
Right, right. Well, I was wondering if we just might get you to read a little bit from your book, Change Baby.
Sure.
And this is where we have Avi, who has gone to a funeral. And she's describing on page 179, I think it is, she's describing a woman in the casket there.
Yes, and this woman is a fairly important person in the story. But I'll just read that section. We peered over the edge of the girly casket at the thing that was both Zephra and not Zephra. Her body did not look utterly abandoned, but neither did she appear to be merely sleeping, as people sometimes say. She never would have slept through what had been done to her. She wasn't completely adverse to cosmetics. I'd known her to apply cold cream and a dusting of Rochelle powder, even to sketch in the suggestion of eyebrows with a dark blonde pencil. But now face, neck, and hands were coated thickly with opaque beige makeup, and a waxy coral lipstick rimmed her peeling mouth. Baby, run go get me my Vaseline jar. Working in the sun all her life, had left Zephyr's skin textured like a Jackson Pollock canvas, layered with irregular pigments and shot through with broken capillaries. It sounds ugly, but that was her patina. She wasn't ugly. She didn't need painting over. Even her hair, normally lank as floss, had been backcombed to the consistency of cotton candy and haloed out around her skull. I'd love to add that that's a big conversation at funerals, is how what a good job they did on the cosmetology.
And it's high praise to say it looks like she's sleeping.
Yeah, yeah. She looked real good. She looked real good. Nobody really looks very good. I don't care how much makeup you put on them.
Well, I mean, there were many moments like that I found in your book about those times, those things that we go through in life, and just those observations about it that were so deftly drawn. So would hear people talking about that, make that kind of observation.
Yeah.
At the funerals. We'll continue our conversation with June Spence, the Raleigh-based author of the new novel, Change Baby. That's coming up. More of our conversation with June Spence. And just ahead, we'll be talking about rock climbing at Hanging Rock. And we welcome your calls to that part of our conversation. Numbers 1-877-962-9862. All of that ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penkava. We're talking with Raleigh author June Spence. Her new novel, her first novel, is out. It's called Change Baby. And this came out after years of writing short stories.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering if, proportionally speaking, does it take longer to write a novel than to do, say, similar number of pages of short stories?
I don't, you know, a short story, because, you know, a 10-page short story can take a really long time. They're just really different animals in the end. I thought what I would end up would be a sort of novel in stories. And the book is sectioned that way, but it just turned into a very different kind of form. They're so hard to compare because a chapter I suppose there were certain chapters when I knew exactly what they would be, I would rattle them off very quickly. And a short story, even a short story might take a great deal longer. But I think just the sort of hugeness of the project of a novel, that just toppled me right and left, I think, in trying to get my mind around it.
You going to do another?
Yeah.
All that said.
Now I'm hooked. What I'm working on now may be more of a novel in stories. Now I'm not so afraid of going at it in increments and seeing what it adds up to. I don't find that so overwhelming. This was a great experiencing sort of getting the nuts and bolts of plot, too.
Would you set this new one in Regina as well?
No. That's a good question. Probably because some other made up name.
You find another anagram for another North Carolina city?
Okay.
Now, this might be a loaded question, but because I know how this story ends, having read that, I don't want to spoil it.
Sure.
Do you believe in happy endings?
Or
the need for them?
I guess I believe in a need for certainly not everything to just come together and be resolved. I think that can never be. I think that, you know, how do you know when your novel is over or your story is over? There's sort of you want to have both a feeling of everything has played itself out, but also a feeling of the lives continuing on past that point. So Yeah, I kind of believe in stopping points in the narrative where you go away and let them all do their own thing after you've stopped looking after them.
Well, and finally, I understand that you work by day as a technical writer. What do you write, and do you ever want to slip in some of this kind of narrative and have these women talking the way they do in your short stories and your novels?
That would be very quickly edited out, I think. I do sort of marketing writing, and the neat thing about the job I do is very acutely attuned to audience. You're writing for several different possible layers of audience, and so as a skill builder, it's very complementary. But it's also different enough that it's something that keeps your skills sharp, but also keeps you sort of hungry to go home and do your fiction, too. Mm-hmm. So,
I hope you stay hungry to do the fiction.
Thanks.
Thank you so much for being with us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
June Spence is the Raleigh-based author of the new novel, her first, Change Baby. She'll be reading at the Regulator in Durham on September 15th and at Quail Ridge in Raleigh on the 16th. And coming up in just a quick moment, rock climbing in Hanging Rock State Park. This is The State of Things, and on Thursdays, we look ahead to the weekend here in North Carolina. Today, we're taking a look at Hanging Rock State Park. It's one of 31 state parks in North Carolina, places that still offer some good old-fashioned, generally free family activity. Now, in just a bit, we'll be talking with a rock climbing enthusiast about his plans for rock climbing at Hanging Rock this weekend. But first, we're talking with the park's superintendent, Eric Nygaard, who is with us by the phone. Hi there, Eric Nygaard.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine. We're also taking your calls this hour. If you have a favorite activity, childhood memory of rock climbing, whatever, give us a call, 1-877-962-9862. Well, Hanging Rock State Park, Eric Nygaard, is not far from Winston-Salem. It's in the western Piedmont region of the state, in the town of Danbury.
That's correct.
It's near the Virginia border, but we should be clear that this may be mountains, but it's not the Blue Ridge Mountains.
That's right. We're the most eastern set of mountains in the Sauratown Mountains, small range just to the south of the Blue Ridge, located both in Stokes and Surrey counties.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, so how did the park get its name? How did Hanging Rock come about?
Well, there is one rock feature, the quartzite rock, that's developed through erosion and uplift over hundreds of millions of years that appears to be a rock that's hanging.
Okay, fair enough. Now, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the place?
Well, the park itself, we're now a 7,000-acre park, but its roots started out, such as many of our North Carolina state parks, by concerned citizens. In 1936, the Winston-Salem Foundation, a philanthropic organization, recognized the importance of the mountains here and decided to try to purchase it for state park.
Mm-hmm. Now, what's particularly unique about this place?
Well, it's sort of a mountainous community within the Piedmont of North Carolina, very close to urban settings, but in a very rural county, Stokes County.
So, in other words, you don't have to drive very. You wouldn't have to if you were living in the Triad or the Triangle area. You don't have to drive very far,
yeah,
as you might otherwise, to go farther west.
About 2 hours from the Durham area. Just 45 minutes to 40 minutes north of Greensboro, Winston-Salem.
Right. So swimming was a big activity in the summertime, I imagine. What do people do in the fall?
Yeah, we have an enormous number of visitors that come, of course, to look at leaf change colors. Our fall weekends will be quite busy and active. We have a 73-site campground that will be full each of the fall weekends, and that should occur about the first week in October through as late as November 15, depending on how beautiful the leaves are.
And of course, one way to see leaves would be to go climbing and get high above, to go climbing on the rocks there. But I hear that you can't just go clambering on them at least legally, that you need a permit?
Well, that's correct, yeah. North Carolina, we recognize it as a climbing is an activity that we do permit in several of our state parks, four of them. And here at Hanging Rock, we provide a permit box. It's essentially a sign-in box to provide us information on how many people are climbing, and some emergency information should we need that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, well, Eric Nygaard, thank you for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Eric Nygaard is superintendent for Hanging Rock State Park in Danbury, North Carolina. You can find a link to their website at the State of Things page at wunc.org. Now, some folks will be rock climbing at Hanging Rock State Park this weekend. One of them is going to be Jim Trogdon. He's a nurse practitioner at UNC Chapel Hill Student Health Clinic by day, but most weekends he's out there scaling the cliffs and mountainsides in North Carolina, and he's on the phone now. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi. Well, tell us about rock climbing here in North Carolina. How does it stack up against other places?
It's great climbing. North Carolina has more rock climbing than one person can do in a lifetime of many varieties.
Oh, really? So what are those varieties here?
There's sport climbing. There's traditional climbing, like what we do at Moores at Hanging Rock, bouldering, of course. And then there's different types of climbing within the type or shape of the cliff, or whether it's leaning out or in, and the type of rock it is to affect the how you will climb.
Now, do all of these involve needing ropes, or lines, and stakes that you would put into the rock to hoist yourself higher? Or
yes.
Okay.
So. Yeah. All except for bouldering, which is just what, like, you know, climbing low on boulders and walls where you just use a mat. Everything else, you require ropes and gear placement with things like what we call wires and nuts and cams, active cams. We don't use the pitons that were used in the olden days because those you have to hammer in and they scar the rock. Whatever we put in, we take out as we're climbing. Mm. The most we do is maybe get some chalk on the rock when we chalk our hands.
Right. Yeah. How did you get into this?
Let's see. When I was 20 or so, I started climbing, and that was 25 years ago. And back then, it was just something I wanted to do. I loved the beauty of the rock, the mountains. And back then, we used tennis shoes and just whatever rope we could find. It was actually pretty untechnical. Now we're using, you know, rubber-soled shoes and...
How does it compare? How does that compare, you know, the old days when I guess you just weren't very high-tech with your gear to now?
Oh, the last 7 years I've really been into it quite a bit, and I really like what I'm doing now because with all the new technology, you can climb things you used to be much more difficult or you couldn't climb before.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I really like all the gear that we have. I also like the engineering stuff that goes with it and stuff.
We're talking with Jim Trogdon, who is a weekend rock climber here in North Carolina. And joining us on the line is John from Greensboro. Hi there, John.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Did you have a tip on a good place to go rock climbing?
Oh, my goodness. Linville Gorge is wonderful. Out at Linville Gorge, there are many, many areas to climb. Depends on what you really are looking for. Do you want the big wall experience? Do you want something a little more... introductory level, you can climb at Pilot Mountain, not on the main knob, but on a cliff line that runs down and to the west of that. There's climbing areas that are close to urban areas, like Crowder's Mountain is very, very close to Charlotte. Rumbling Bald is close to Fayetteville. You know, there's a number of areas that you can climb. And
Linville Gorge being out in the very northwestern part of the state,
mm-hmm.
And you speak of the big wall experience. How tall, we're talking the side of, well, I guess some of us who are lay people about this might call it a mountain,
mm-hmm.
but you're talking about the a sheer cliff, perhaps?
What you're looking for is the exposed rock of the mountain. At Linville Gorge, you'll take a drive from the base to the exposed rock. It takes about an hour just to get there, you know, from the part where you actually turn into Linville Gorge proper. Places like Linville Gorge have areas of climbing that range in the 200 to 500 feet, you know, of climbing, some a little smaller, some a little larger. You can go to Looking Glass Rock, which is well in the western part of the state, and get things that are 3,000 feet in height.
How would you suggest, I'm curious, you, John, and also you, Jim Trogdon, how would you suggest somebody new to this get started?
I think the best way is to, as with anything, take it with slow and measured steps. Most people's first introduction to rock climbing is either through a friend or through a rock climbing gym, an indoor rock climbing gym. We have one here in Greensboro. It's the Ultimate Climbing Gym at Tumblebees. And we have a lot of people that come in for their very first experience just to try to see what it's like. And that's a very safe environment. You're on pre-established routes, indoors. A lot of the outdoor conditions are controlled. When you go outdoors with someone, you're really looking for their experience, for their expertise to ease you into the sport in a very safe and controlled fashion.
Jim Trogdon, do you have to be in really good fit shape to take this on?
All according to what level of climbing you want to do, really. The level, the grades vary from what we call 5.5, 5.4, all the way up to 5.12. So all according to how hard you want to climb affects how what kind of shape you need to be in. But you need to be in pretty decent shape because, as the other gentleman just stated, I mean, you have approaches that are sometimes the approach to get to the cliff is more energy than you'll spend climbing the cliff.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because especially going down into Linville Gorge, like going down to do the Mummy and the Daddy, some of the 500, 400-foot walls.
That's what they call them, Mummy and Daddy?
Well, there's two climbs that are real popular down there that a lot of people have done down in the Linville Gorge. Yeah, and the approach to that is probably more dangerous than the climb, and you'll expend more energy, at least I think you do.
What could be more dangerous, I guess, in this whole scenario than trying to go up the face of something? What would be dangerous about getting there?
Well, you have rope and protection, and you're actually in control of the situation when you climb. I feel much safer when I'm climbing than I am when I'm in my car, or when you descend the gully to get down to some places that you go to, like Linville Gorge. These gullies are wet, deep, unprotected, and you've got packs on. So, you know, the climbing part's, I think, sometimes easier than the approach is the only reason I said that.
Yeah. I wonder, are you able in some places in North Carolina to climb up, like one day stay at the top? And are there places to stay at the top and then come back the next day? Can you do it that way? Or is it a matter of spending a few hours on the rock and that's
Permutations of that, yes. I have gone to Linville Gorge before and climbed. It takes a while to climb down into the gorge and then sleep the night and then climb like 200 or 300, 400-foot cliffs and then later that evening climb out on another climb and climb like out of the gorge to the top. The thing about Linville Gorge is it's kind of opposite. You're at the top and you're going down, whereas a lot of places where you go to climb, you get to the base of the mountain and then go up. But
That is odd, yeah.
Yeah, it's quite beautiful. Yeah. It's a gorgeous place.
Yeah, especially in the fall?
Yes, yes, especially climbing to the top of Table Rock and looking over North Carolina is an incredible view.
Yeah.
Linville Gorge is like the Grand Canyon of the East. It's really one of the few places that wasn't logged because it is so rugged. So you get the beauty of, you know, nature at its purest.
Yeah, I've never done the rock climbing part, but having hiked through there a little bit and going through these rhododendron, I think they were rhododendron that seemed like 10 feet high. You felt like you were looking for the unicorn to come through in the fairy tale. It was that kind of experience.
Well, I'd like to add a piece just real quick to the climbing. Climbing indoors in a gym in a controlled environment is a safe and good way to start. It's a great way to get your feet wet and learn how to tie the knots and put your belt on, your harness. But eventually you have to climb outside, because I would compare climbing inside in a gym to climbing outside, the difference between real whipped cream and non-fat whipped cream.
He's absolutely right.
When you go outside, it's just
beautiful.
Not the same thing.
Right.
Yeah.
And how about, is bouldering a good way to get started? Or
it's a good way to get strong.
Yeah.
It's a different sport.
It's a different sport. It's for younger climbers. They gravitate towards it because it has less expense. Mm-hmm. Really, all you need is a good pair of climbing shoes and a couple of buddies to make sure that if you do come off the boulder, that they're going to make sure that you land on your feet or bring a crash pad. It's very inexpensive. Mm-hmm. It is also very, very high strength exercise. So younger climbers tend to gravitate towards it more than climbers who've been at it for a while.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining us today and maybe inspiring more people to take on some rock climbing.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thanks for being with us today. Thanks, John in Greensboro, and thanks to Jim Trogdon, who is a weekend rock climber. You can get more information about Hanging Rock State Park at their website. That's at our website, the link. Go to State of Things page at wunc.org. And you can also We mean this. You can watch The State of Things now on WRAL's digital cable at noon and 5 o'clock every weekday. You can check our website for more. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.